Side 8, Ilium by Dan Simmons. Continuing on page 224. An hour and a half later, the city is coming alive and I am walking the streets, fully garbed in my usual Skolix gear and morphed as a Thracian spearman. The sun has risen and the city is coming fully alive with crowded streets opening, market stalls, driven animals, running children, and swaggering warriors breaking their fast before going out to kill. Near the marketplace, I find Neitenhauser, morphed as a Dardanian watchman but visible as Neitenhauser through my lenses, eating breakfast in an outdoor restaurant we've both frequented. He looks up and recognizes me. I don't flee or use the Hades helmet to disappear. I join him at the table under a low tree and order bread, dried fish, and fruit for breakfast. "Our muse was hunting for you at the barracks before dawn this morning," says the portly Neitenhauser. "And again near the walls here this morning, she was asking after you by name. She seems eager to locate you." "Are you worried about being seen with me?" I ask. "Want me to move on?" Neitenhauser shrugs. "All of us Skolix are on borrowed time anyway. What does it matter? Tempus adox rerum." I've been thinking in ancient Greek for so long that it takes me a second to translate the Latin. Time is a devourer. Perhaps so. But I want more of it. I break the fresh hot bread and eat, marveling at the glorious taste of it and of the sweet breakfast wine. Everything looks, smells, and tastes crisper, cleaner, newer, and more wonderful this morning. Perhaps it was the night's rain. Perhaps it was something else. "You smell suspiciously perfumed this morning," says Neitenhauser. At first, my only response is a blush. Can the other Skolix smell the night's revelries on me? But then I realize what he's talking about. Helen had insisted I bathe with her before leaving. The old female slave who had directed the carrying of the hot water to the bath, I'd learned, was Aethra, Pittheus' daughter, wife of King Aegis, and mother of the famous Theseus, ruler of Athens and the man who had abducted Helen when she was 11. I remembered the name Aethra from my graduate school days, but my instructor, Dr. Fertig, a fine Homerian scholar, had insisted that the name had been drawn at random from the epic stock. Aethra, daughter of Pittheus, must have sounded good to Homer or some poetic predecessor who needed a name for a mere slave, said Dr. Fertig, and that the noble Theseus' mother couldn't possibly be Helen's servant in Troy. Well, wrong, Dr. Fertig. Just half an hour ago, lounging in the sunken marble tub with a naked Helen, she mentioned that the old slave woman Aethra was indeed Theseus' mom, that Helen's brothers Castor and Polydeuces, when they rescued her from Theseus' captivity, had carried off the old lady as punishment, and Paris had brought her along to Troy with Helen. "Thinking about something, Hockenberry?" asked Neitenhauser. I blushed again. Right then I had been thinking about Helen's soft breast, visible through the bubbles in the bath. I ate some fish and said, "I wasn't on the field yesterday evening. Anything interesting happen?" "Nothing much. Just Hector's big duel with Ajax, just the showdown we've been waiting for since the Achaean ships first touched their bows to shore down there, just all of Book 7. "Oh, that," I said. Book 7 was an exciting duel between Hector and the Achaean giant, but nothing happened. Neither man hurt the other, even though Ajax was obviously the better fighter. And when evening made it too dark to fight, Ajax and Hector called a truce, exchanged gifts of armor and weapons, and both sides went back to burn their dead. I hadn't missed anything crucial, nothing to give up 1 minute with Helen. "There was something odd," said Neitenhauser. I ate bread and waited. "You know that Hector was supposed to come out of the city with his brother Paris, and both were supposed to lead the Trojans back into battle. Homer says that Paris kills Menestheus at the beginning of the fight, yes? And later, do you remember when King Priam's counselor, Antenor, advises his fellow Trojans to give back Helen and all the treasures looted from Argos? Give them back and let the Achaeans go away in peace? That's while Ajax and Hector are pals after they fail to kill each other, exchanging gifts on the field, right?" I say. "Yes." "Well, what about it?" Neitenhauser sets his goblet down. "Well, it was Paris who was supposed to answer Antenor and urge his fellow Trojans to refuse to surrender Helen, but offers to give up the treasures in exchange for peace. So, I say, realizing where this is going, my stomach suddenly feels queasy. Well, Paris wasn't there last night, not to come out of the Scaean gates with Hector, not to kill Menestheus, and not even to offer the peace proposal at dusk. I nod in Truso. So, that's one of the largest discrepancies we've seen, isn't it, Hockenberry? I have to shrug again. I don't know, Book 7 has the Achaeans building their defensive wall and trench near the shore, but you and I know that those defenses have been there since the first month after they arrived. Homer messes up the chronology sometimes. Nightenhauser looks at me. Perhaps, but the absence of Paris to refute Antenor's suggestion about giving up Helen was strange. Finally, King Priam spoke for his son, saying that he was sure that Paris would never surrender the woman, but that he might give up the treasure. But without Paris being there in person, a lot of the Trojans in the crowd were mumbling their agreement. It's the closest thing to peace breaking out that I've seen in all the years I've been here, Hockenberry. My skin feels cold. My self-indulgence with Helen last night, my long impersonation of Paris, has already changed something important in the flow of things. If the Muse had known the details of the Iliad, which she didn't, she would have known at once that I had taken Paris's place in bed with Helen. Did you report the discrepancy to the Muse? I asked softly. Nightenhauser would have gone off shift when darkness fell. Since I was missing, he was the only Skoldic on duty last evening. It was his duty to report such oddities. Nightenhauser chews the last of his bread slowly. No, he says at last. I didn't dictate that to the word stone. I let out a breath. Thank you, I say. We'd better go, says the other Skoldic. The restaurant is filling up with Trojan men and their wives waiting for a seat. As I drop coins on the table, Nightenhauser grips my forearm. Do you know what you're doing, Hockenberry? I look him in the eye. My voice is firm when I respond. Absolutely not. Once on the street, I go the opposite direction from Nightenhauser. Stepping into an empty alley, I pull up the cowl of the Hades helmet and touch the QT medallion. It is sunrise on the summit of Mount Olympus. The white buildings and green lawns reflect the rich but lesser light here. I've always wondered why the sun seems smaller on and around Olympus than in the skies above Ilium. I had envisioned the chariot stand near the Muses building, and that's where I have arrived. I hold my breath as a chariot spirals down from the morning sky and lands not 20 feet from me. But Apollo steps out and strides away without noticing me. The Hades helmet still works. I step onto the chariot and touch the bronze plate near the front. I had watched the Muse carefully as she flew us across the Caldera Lake the other day. A glowing, transparent keyplate comes into existence inches above the brass. I touch the icons there in the sequence I'd watched the Muse use. The chariot wobbles, rises, wobbles again, and steadies itself as I move the glowing virtual energy controller next to the readouts. I twist it left, and the chariot banks left 50 feet above the summit grass. I touch the forward arrow icon, and the chariot leaps ahead, flying south over the blue lake. To any god watching, it should look like an empty chariot flying itself, but no god is visible to watch. Across the lake, I gain a bit of altitude and try to find the right building. There, just beyond the great hall of the gods. Some goddess, I do not recognize her, cries out from the front steps of the huge building and points toward my seemingly empty chariot. But it's too late. I've identified the building I want, huge, white, with an open doorway. I'm getting the knack of the chariot controls now, and I dive within 20 feet of the ground and accelerate toward the building. I have to lift the left side of the chariot almost perpendicular to the ground. I do not fall. There is some artificial gravity in the machine as I zip between the giant columns at 40 or 50 miles per hour. Inside, the space is as I remember it, the giant vats filled with bubbling violet liquid, green worms roiling around the unconscious, floating, healing gods. The healer, the giant centipede thing with metallic arms and red eyes, is on the opposite side of Aphrodite's reconstruction vat, preparing to remove her from it, I presume. His red eyes look my way, and his many arms quiver as the chariot rushes into the quiet space. but he is not between me and my target, and I accelerate forward before he or anything else can stop me. It is only at the last second that I decide to jump rather than to stay with the chariot. It must be the memory of Helen, the night with Helen, the renewed pleasure of life in those hours with Helen. The Hades helmet still shielding me, I leap from the speeding chariot. Land hard, feel something bruise, if not break, in my right shoulder, and then I tumble to a stop on the floor as the chariot flies directly into the reconstruction vat, smashing plastic and steel, throwing violet liquid 100 feet into the air of the giant room. Something, either part of the chariot or a huge shard of vat glass, slices the giant centipede healer in two. Aphrodite's body rolls out onto the floor in a wave of violet liquid and a coiling mass of writhing green worms. The other vats, including the one holding Ares in his nest of worms, rock but do not break or tumble. Klaxons, alarms, and sirens go off, deafening me. I try to rise, but my head, left leg, and right shoulder ache terribly, and I sink back to the floor. I crawl to one side of the room, trying to stay out of the violet goo. I'm afraid of what the chemicals will do to me, but more afraid that the outline of my body will be visible in the flood if I can't get away from it. Black spots dance in my vision, and I realize I'm going to pass out. Gods and floating robot machines are rushing into the great healing chamber. In the seconds before I lose consciousness, I see mighty Zeus stride in, his cloak billowing, his brow furrowed. Whatever's going to happen next will have to happen without me. I set my forehead against the cool floor, close my eyes, and let the blackness wash over me. 22. The Coast of Chrysi Planitia. I killed my friend, Orfu of Io, Monmouth told William Shakespeare. The two were walking in neighborhoods along the bank of the Thames. Monmouth knew that it was the late summer of 1592 AD, although he did not know how he knew. The river was busy with barges, wherries, and low-masted river craft. Beyond the Tudor buildings and ramshackle tenements on the north bank rose a profusion of London steeples and a few contorted towers. A hot haze hung over the river and behind the slums on either side. I should have saved Orfu, but I could not, said Monmouth. He had to walk quickly to keep up with the playwright. Shakespeare was a compact man in his late 20s, soft-spoken and dressed in a more dignified manner than Monmouth would have expected from an actor and playwright. The young man's face was a sharp oval, showing a hairline already receding, sideburns and a wisp of a beard and thin mustache, as if Shakespeare were tentatively experimenting with a more permanent beard. His hair was brown, his eyes a grayish-green, and he wore a black doublet from which the wide, soft collars of a white shirt were visible, white drawstrings hanging down. There was a small gold hoop in the writer's left ear. Monmouth wanted to ask Shakespeare 1,000 questions. What was he writing now? What was life like in this city that would soon be overwhelmed by the plague? What is the hidden structure of the sonnets? But all he could talk about was Orfu. I tried to save him, explained Monmouth. The Dark Lady's reactor shut down and then the batteries went dead less than 5 kilometers from the coast. I was trying to find an inlet in one of the many caves along the cliffs. Someplace we could hide the sub. The Dark Lady? Asked Shakespeare. This is the name of your ship? Yes. Pray continue. Orfu and I were talking about the stone faces, said Monmouth. It was night. We were approaching the coast at night under cover of darkness, but I was using the night vision scope and was describing the faces to him. He was still alive. The ship was providing just enough O2 for him. O2? Air, explained Monmouth. As I say, I was describing the great stone heads to him. Great stone heads? Statues? Stone monoliths, each about 20 meters tall, said Monmouth. Did you recognize the statue's visage? Was he someone of your acquaintance, or perhaps a famous king or conqueror? It was too far away for me to see details of the faces, said Monmouth. They had come to a wide, multi-arched bridge covered with 3-story buildings. A passageway about 4 meters wide ran right through the structures like a road through a tunnel, and at the moment pedestrians in motley were dodging a mass of sheep being driven north into the city. All along that walkway, human heads, some dried and mummified, some almost skulls except for tufts of hair or bits of rotted flesh, others so shockingly fresh that there was still a blush to the cheeks or lips, had been mounted on posts.
"What is all this?" asked Monmouth. His organic parts felt queasy.
"London Bridge," said Shakespeare. "Tell me what happened to your friend." Tired of looking up at the playwright, Monmouth scampered up onto a stone wall that served as a railing. He could see a forbidding tower in the east, and he assumed it was the tower from Richard III. Knowing that he was either dreaming or dying from lack of air himself, Monmouth did not want this dream to end before he asked Shakespeare a question or two. "Have you begun writing your sonnets yet, Master Shakespeare?" The playwright smiled and looked out at the reeking Thames, then turned to gaze at the stinking city. Raw sewage was everywhere, as were the carcasses of dead horses and cattle rotting in the mud flats, while a wild effluvium of bloody chicken parts flowed out from open gutters and swirled in stagnant backwaters. Monmouth had all but shut off his olfactory input. He didn't know how this human with his full-time nose could stand it.
"How do you know about my experiment with the sonnet?" asked Shakespeare.
Monmouth approximated a human shrug. "I guess, so you've begun them?" "I've considered playing with the form," admitted the playwright. "Then who is the young man in the sonnets?" asked Monmouth, hardly able to breathe at the thought of unraveling this ancient mystery. "Is it Henry Wriothesley, the Earl of Southampton?" Shakespeare blinked in surprise and looked carefully at the Mourvèque. "You seem to follow close on my heels in such things, Tiny Caliban." Monmouth nodded. "So Wriothesley is the youth in the sonnets?" "His lordship will have seen 19 years this October, and the down on his upper lip, it is said, has turned to sedge," said the playwright. "Hardly a youth." "William Herbert, then," suggested Monmouth. "He's only 12 years old, and he'll become the 3rd Earl of Pembroke 9 years from now." "You know the dates of future succession and accession," Shakespeare said with a tone of irony. "Does Master Caliban sail time's sea as well as this ocean of Mars he speaks of?" Monmouth was too excited about solving this mystery to respond to that. "You'll dedicate the large folio of 1623 to William Herbert and his brother, and when your sonnets are printed, you'll dedicate them to Mr. W.H. Shakespeare stared at the Mourvèque as if he were a fever dream. Monmouth wanted to say, "No, you're the dream of a dying brain, Master Shakespeare, not I." Aloud he said, "I just think it's interesting that you have a young man or a boy as a lover." Monmouth was surprised by the poet's reaction. Shakespeare turned, drew a dagger from his belt, and held it under the Mourvèque's head unit. "Do you have an eye, little Caliban, that I may bury my blade in it?" Careful not to lower his permaflesh deeper onto the point of the blade, Monmouth shook his head very slightly and said, "I apologize. I am a stranger to your town, to your country, and to the manners here. See those closest 3 heads on posts on the bridge?" asked Shakespeare. Monmouth shifted his vision without moving his head. "Yes. This time last week, they were strangers to our manners," hissed the poet. "I get the point," said Monmouth. "No pun intended, sir." Shakespeare slid the dagger back in its leather scabbard. Monmouth remembered that the man was an actor given to flourishes and exaggerations. Although the dagger had been no stage prop, nor had Shakespeare's response been a denial to Monmouth's question. Both looked back out at the river. The sun hung impossibly large and orange and low in the river haze to the west. Shakespeare's voice was soft when he spoke. "If I pen these sonnets, Caliban, I will do so to explore my own failures, weaknesses, compromises, self-conceits, and sad ambiguities in the way that one probes a bloody socket for the missing tooth after a barroom brawl. How did you kill your friend, this Orfu of Io?" Monmouth had to take a second to catch up to the question. "I couldn't get the Dark Lady to the cave inlet I had seen along the coast," he said. "I tried and failed. The sub's reactor died suddenly, the power went out, The lady went aground in less than 4 fathoms of water, 3 kilometers or so from the cave. I tried blowing all the ballast tanks to bring her on her side so I could free the bay doors to get to my friend, but she was already stuck fast. Monmouth looked at the poet. Shakespeare seemed to be paying attention. The buildings on the bridge behind him were red with the Thames sunset. I went outside and went on internal O2 and dived for hours, continued Monmouth. I used pry bars and the last of the acetylene and my manipulator fingers, but I couldn't open the bay doors, couldn't clear the debris in the flooded accessway to the hold. Orfu was on comm line for a while, but then I lost him as the internal systems failed. He never sounded worried, never frightened, just tired, very tired. Right up to when the comm failed, it was dark, I must have lost consciousness. Perhaps I'm at the bottom of the Martian ocean right now, dead with Orfu, or dying, dreaming this conversation, as the last cells of my organic brain shut down. Thy bosom is endeared with all hearts, said Shakespeare, his voice a monotone, which you by lacking have supposed dead, and there reigns love and all love's loving parts, and all the friends which you thought buried. Monmouth regained consciousness to find himself on the beach in low morning Martian daylight and surrounded by dozens of little green men. They were bent over him, staring with small black eyes set into their green, transparent faces, and they backed a step or two away when Monmouth sat up with a slight whir of his servos. They were little. Monmouth was just over a meter tall. These persons were shorter than that. They were humanoid in form, more so than Monmouth, but not really human in appearance. They were bipedal, with arms and legs, but had no ears, no noses, and no mouths. They wore no clothes and had only 3 fingers on each hand, rather like cartoon characters Monmouth had seen in the Lost Age media archives. They were sexless, Monmouth noted, and their flesh, if flesh it was transparent like soft plastic, revealing insides without organs or veins, bodies filled with floating green globules and clumps, particles and blobs all flowing and bubbling in a way not that now abandoned with the sunken submersible. More little green men were coming down a trail set into the cliff face. Monmouth could see the last of the erected stone faces a kilometer or so to the east. Another was visible, horizontal on a long wooden pallet set on rollers far above them near the edge of the cliff, bound about by ropes. The details of the faces were not discernible. To hell with the heads. Monmouth whirled and searched the sea and beach. Tepid waves rolled in with the regularity of a metronome. Where's the dark lady? There she was. 200 meters out, part of the upper hull and command superstructure clearly visible. Her fathometer and sonar had died before she had, and Monmouth had committed perhaps the most ancient and most grievous of sea captain's offenses, running his ship aground. He had been on internal O2 while working wildly to free the hold doors on the sandy, muddy sea bottom, but he realized that he must have passed out, been washed ashore here during the night. Orfu. How long had he been unconscious, dreaming of Shakespeare? Monmouth's internal chronometer said that it had been a bit less than 4 hours. He still might be alive in there. He started walking toward the water, intending to walk the bottom all the way out to the stranded submersible. A dozen little green men moved between Monmouth and the water, blocking his way, then 20, then 50. 100 more surrounded him on the beach. Monmouth had never lifted his hand or manipulator in anger, but he was ready to fight now, to punch and slash and kick his way through this mob if he had to. But he would try to talk to them first. Get out of my way, he said, voice on full amplification and sounding loud in the Martian air, please. The black eyes in green faces stared at him, but they had neither ears to hear him with nor mouths to speak with. Monmouth laughed sadly and started to push his way through them, knowing that however much stronger he might be, they could overcome him by sheer numbers, sit on him while they tore him apart. The thought of such violence, his or theirs, made his organic insides clutch with horror. One of the little green men held his hand up as if to say stop. Monmouth paused, All the green heads turned to the right and looked up the beach. The mob parted magically as a little green man who looked exactly like the other little green man approached, stopped in front of Monmouth, and extended both hands as if cupping an invisible bowl or praying. Monmouth did not understand, nor did he want to take time to parley through sign language even if he could. Orfu might still be alive. He started to brush past the little man, but a score of others closed ranks behind this emissary, blocking Monmouth's way. He would either have to fight now or pay attention to the gesturing green figure. Monmouth let out a sigh not much different than a moan and paused, holding his hands out in mimicry of the little green man's gesture. The emissary shook his head, touched Monmouth's left arm. Both organic and Moravecian sensors told him that the green fingers were cool, and lowered Monmouth's left arm, then gripped the right. The little green man pulled Monmouth's hand closer, closer, until the Moravec's fingers and palm were flat against the cool, transparent flesh. The little green man pulled harder, pushing himself forward and pulling Monmouth's hand hard enough that the Moravec's palm dented the flat chest, pressed the flesh inward, then penetrated. Monmouth would have drawn his hand back in shock at this, but the little green man did not relent with his grip or with his strong pull. Monmouth could see his dark hand entering the fluid of the little green man's chest, could feel the transparent flesh closing tight around his forearm in a vacuum seal. All of the little green men raised their hands to their chests. Monmouth's splayed fingers encountered something hard, almost spherical. He could see a green blob about the size of a human heart centered in the man's chest. His palm felt it pulse. The little green man pulled again and Monmouth understood. He closed his organic fingers around the organ. "What do you need?" Shocked, Monmouth almost jerked his hand free. He forced himself to leave his fingers where they were, wrapped around the little man's green heart blob. Monmouth had felt the question flow up to his brain in pulses, throbs, vibrations. Not in words, certainly not in English or French or Russian or Chinese or primary, or any language Monmouth had ever used. He did not know how to respond in kind, so he spoke. "I need to save my friend who is trapped in the ship out there." 150 green heads turned in unison to look at the submersible. 300 black eyes gazed a few seconds and then turned their gaze back on Monmouth. "Tell us with your thoughts where he is." Monmouth closed his eyes and formed an image of Orfu in the blocked hold. An image of the bay doors, an image of the interior corridor. The vibration response throbbed back up his arm. "Wait." Monmouth's hand was suddenly free, and he pulled it from the little green man's tight flesh with an audible squishing sound. The little green man collapsed onto the sand then, rolling on his side and lying motionless. The green blobs in his body ceased to flow. His black eyes clouded white and stared blindly, and his fingers twitched once and were still. The 140-something of the others turned away and went efficiently about the task of saving Orfu. Monmouth collapsed onto the sand next to what was clearly the emissary's lifeless corpse. "Mother of God," thought the Moravec, "it kills them to communicate." More little green men kept coming down the steep path from the cliff, 200, 300, 600. Monmouth quit trying to count and ignoring the dead emissary's request for him to wait. He waded and then paddled through the slight surf to the grounded submersible. Monmouth went down through the conning tower airlock into his dry enviro crash, checking to see if any of the batteries had come back online. They hadn't. He cycled through the internal airlock into the flooded corridor to the hold and swam down to the collapsed hull there. No way through to Orfu that way. Returning to the control room, he tried the hardline comm again. Silence. Salvaging his hardback edition of the Sonnet safe in a waterproof wrapper, Monmouth stuffed other gear into a backpack, the remote comm he'd devised for Orfu if he could get him out, the ship's log disks, hard copy maps, a flare pistol, power cells, and clambered up to the top of the conning tower. The little green men had brought great coils of their black cable down from the stone head they had been hauling along the cliff. They also brought scores of the rollers that the huge pallet had been moving on. They worked with an unbelievable efficiency, some swimming out to the submersible, and attaching lines both above and under the waterline, others sinking metal rods from the rollers deep into the sand while pounding others into the rocky cliff face, still rigging pulleys and running the cable from the shore to the sub and back to the shore. The sub was heavy, especially heavy with its water-damped reactor, flooded hold and corridors. And Monmouth had trouble imagining these tiny green men actually moving the thing. But they did. Within 20 minutes, there were hundreds of cables running to the sub and then ashore, and many little green men on each cable. They understood it was a rescue mission. The first thing they did was pull hard enough from the shore, the cable stretching like a black web back to the beach to the east, to tip the sub on its right side. Monmouth's instinct was to go help pull on the cables, but he knew that would be useless. Instead, he waited on the hull of the Dark Lady, shifting as the submersible shifted. And as soon as the bay doors were clear of the mud, he dove into the shallow water with a cell-powered pry bar, his shoulder lamps on full bright. The hull bay doors had been twisted and partially melted by entry into the atmosphere, and Monmouth was unable to open them more than a few centimeters before they jammed completely. Wanting to weep with frustration, pounding the hull with impotent fury, he suddenly had the sense that he was not alone, and he swung around in the silt-filled seawater. Half a dozen little green men stood on the bottom of the sea nearby, watching him. They did not seem to need to breathe. Not wanting to communicate with them again at the price of killing one of them, Monmouth pointed to the pried-up section of door, pointed to the surface, made a gesture of rolling cable and wrapping it around the torn flange of metal, and pantomimed pulling. All six of the little green men nodded and kicked for the surface 3 meters above them. A minute later, 60 of them returned, some pulling cable, others with the black rods that slid out of the rollers they used to pull the stone heads. Again, they worked with improbable efficiency, some working as a team to twist back a few centimeters of the doors at the opposite end of the hold bay, others running cable through as if threading a needle. Within a few minutes, they had dozens of strands of the strong cable running beneath the jammed bay doors. They kicked to the surface again, gesturing Monmouth to follow. Again, he breathed air, felt sunlight on his polymer and skin, and stood on the Dark Lady's hull as hundreds of the little green men rigged the cables through a system of cliffside pulleys and pulled. And pulled again. The submersible creaked, the hull groaned, silt surrounded them, and the Dark Lady rolled another 30 degrees to starboard and twisted around until the belly of the ship was in the air and the stern was pointed toward the beach. The alloy bay doors bent but did not open. Monmouth attacked the doors with his powered pry bar again. The tortured and twisted metal would not relent. His acetylene torch was out of O2 and energy. The little green man gently pulled him away from his fruitless labors. Monmouth pulled free and stumbled across the slippery hull toward the hold again, intent on prying at the warped and jammed doors until his own energy cells died. But then he saw that the LGM weren't finished with their efforts. They knotted and spliced cable, turning the 50 strands into one. Then they ran the lengthened cable up the cliff face and through a series of oversized pulleys connected to a latticework of support rods they had somehow driven into the stone. Finally, they ran the cable to the huge stone head and wrapped the ends around the figure's neck a dozen times before tying it off. 5 of the little green men came over and pushed Monmouth into the water, pulling him away from the sub. Monmouth could not believe what he was seeing. He had assumed that the great stone faces were sacred to the little green men. Their positioning and raising along the coast a religious or psychological imperative calling for all of their time, energy, and devotion. The stone heads their only priority. Evidently, he was wrong. Hundreds of the green figures wrestled the head around on its pallet, got behind it, shoved, and pushed it off the cliff. The stone head, its face to the cliff now, fell 60 meters, striking rocks at the base of the cliff and shattering into a dozen pieces. But the cable whirred on pulleys, rods popped out of stone, and the tied-off ends ripped the hold bay doors off and threw them 20 meters into the air before dragging the torn metal up the cliff and back down again. Hundreds of little green men swam for the sub, but Monmouth reached it first, flicking on his searchlights again. There were the 3 objects he'd left in the hold, including the large device they were supposed to deliver to Mons Olympus. and tucked into the creche, battered and torn and silent, was Orfu of Io. Monmouth used the last power in his pry bar to rip free the arresting flanges and tie-downs. Orfu's great bulk sagged free, sloshing in seawater, but the bay was opened skyward now, the sub on its back, and there was no way that Monmouth could ever get the Ionian out of the partially flooded pit the storage bay had become. A dozen more little green men jumped into the space with Monmouth, found grasping points on Orfu's pitted and cracked carapace, and forced green arms and legs under the hard-vac Moravec's ungainly shape. Together they found leverage and lifted. Working silently, never slipping or dropping him, they lifted Orfu out, gently wrapped more cables around him, slid him across the curve of the Dark Lady's hull, lowered him to the water, set buoyant rollers under him, lashed them together into a raft, and gently propelled the Ionian's body to the beach. The little green men, at least 1,000 strong on the beach now, stood back and gave Monmouth room as he worked to find out if Orfu was dead or alive. The Ionian lay inert on the red sand beach like some storm-battered, oversized trilobite washed ashore in one of Earth's dim prehistoric ages. Checking the skies for flying chariots that Monmouth was sure were overdue, he emptied his backpack and waterproof bags of the gear he'd salvaged from the Dark Lady. First he laid out 5 of these small but heavy power cells, connected them in series, and ran the cable to one of Orfu's surviving input connectors. There was no response from the big Ionian, but the virtual indicator showed that the energy was flowing somewhere. Next, Monmouth crawled up the curve of Orfu's carapace, marveling at seeing the physical damage clearly for the first time here in the strong morning light, and screwed the radio receiver into the hardline socket. He tested the connection, receiving a carrier wave hum, and activated his own microphone. Orfu? No response. Orfu? Silence. The scores of little green men looked on impassively. Orfu? Monmouth spent 5 minutes at the task, calling once every 20 seconds, using all comm frequencies and rechecking the receiver's connections. The comm unit was receiving his transmission. It was Orfu who was not responding. Orfu? There wasn't silence, exactly. From his external pickups, Monmouth could hear more ambient noise than he'd ever encountered in his life. The lap of waves against the sand, the hiss of wind against the cliff behind him, the soft stir of the little green men shifting position from time to time, and the 1,000 nuances of vibrations in such a thick planetary atmosphere. It was just the comm line and Orfu that were dead. Orfu? Monmouth checked his chronometer. He had been at it for more than 30 minutes. Reluctantly, in slow motion, he slid down off his friend's carapace, walked 15 paces down the beach, and sat in the wet sand where the water rolled in. The little green men made way for him and then surrounded him again at a respectful distance. Monmouth looked at them, at the wall of tiny green bodies, expressionless faces and unblinking black eyes. "Don't you all have work to do?" he asked, his voice sounding strange and choked to his own auditory inputs. Perhaps it was the acoustics of the Martian atmosphere. The LGM did not move. The stone head was smashed into rubble at the base of the cliff, but the little green men ignored it. A score of cables still ran out to the submersible where it lay inert in the low, rolling surf. Monmouth felt a sudden and immeasurably deep wave of loss and homesickness roll over him. He'd had 3 close relationships in his 3 Jovian decades, more than 300 Martian years of existence. First, the Dark Lady, which had been only a semi-sentient machine, but for which he'd been designed and in which he fit perfectly. The lady was dead. Second, his exploration partner, Ertzweil, killed 18J years ago, half of Monmouth's lifetime ago. Now Orfu. Now here he was, hundreds of millions of kilometers from home, alone, unfit, untrained, and unprepared for this mission they'd sent him on. How was he supposed to get the 5,000 or so kilometers to Olympus Mons to plant the device? And what if he did? Goras III may have known what to do there, what this mission was really about, but lowly Monmouth, late of the Dark Lady, didn't have a fucking clue. Quit feeling sorry for yourself, idiot, he thought. Monmouth glanced at the LGM. It surely must be an illusion that they seemed downcast, even sad. They hadn't mourned the death of one of their own. How could they show that emotion at the end of a Morvec, a sentient machine they'd never imagined? Monmouth knew that he would have to communicate with the little green men again, but he hated the thought of reaching into one of the creature's chests, of killing it through communication. No, he wouldn't do that until he had to. He stood, returned to Orfu's corpse, and began disconnecting the power cells.
Hey, said Orfu on the comm band, I'm still eating.
Monmouth was so startled he actually jumped backward in the sand. Jesus, you're alive.
As much as any of us Moraveks are alive.
God damn you, said Monmouth, feeling like laughing and crying, but mostly like hitting the big battered horseshoe crab. Why didn't you answer me when I called and called and called?
What do you mean? Said Orfu. I was in hibernation. Have been ever since the air and energy ran out on the lady. You expect me to chat with you while I'm in hibernation?
What is this hibernation shit? Said Monmouth, pacing around Orfu. I never heard of Moravex going into hibernation.
You European Vex don't have it? Asked Orfu.
Obviously not.
Well, what can I say? Working alone in our space. We hardvac Moravex sometimes run into situations where we just have to shut down everything for a while until someone can get to us to repair and recharge us. It happens. Not often, but it happens.
How long could you have stayed in this hibernation? Asked Monmouth, his anger shifting into something like giddiness.
Not long, said Orfu. About 500 hours.
Monmouth extended fingers through his manipulator pads, picked up a rock and bounced it off Orfu's shell.
Did you hear something? Asked the Ionian.
Monmouth sighed, sat in the sand near the end of Orfu that used to house his eyes, and began describing their current situation. Orfu convinced Monmouth that he'd have to communicate with the LGM through a translator again. The Ionian hated the idea of causing the death of one of the little green men as much as Monmouth did, especially since the LGM had rescued him. But he argued that the mission depended on them communicating and communicating fast. Monmouth had tried talking again, had tried sign language, had tried drawings in the sand, showing maps of the coast where they were and the volcano they had to get to, had even tried the idiot's version of speaking a foreign language, shouting. The LGM all stared calmly but did not respond. Finally, it was the little green man who took the initiative, stepping forward, seizing Monmouth's hand and pulling it to his chest. Shall I? Monmouth asked Orfu over the comm line.
You have to.
Monmouth winced as his hand was pulled through the yielding flesh, as his fingers encircled and then gripped what could only be a beating green heart in the warm, syrupy fluid of the little man's body. How can we help you? Monmouth had 100 questions he wanted to ask, but Orfu helped him put first things first.
The sub, said Orfu. We have to get it out of sight before a chariot flies over.
Through a combination of language and images, Monmouth conveyed the thought of moving the submersible a kilometer or so to the west, of pulling it into the ocean cave in the cliff that jutted out to sea at the headland.
Yes.
Scores of the little green men began to work, even while Monmouth stood there, his hand deep in the translator's chest.
They began sinking rods into the sand, running more cables to the Dark Lady, and rigging pulleys. The translator waited with Monmouth's hand around his heart. I want to ask him about the Stoneheads, said Monmouth over the comm line. Ask him who they are, why they're doing this.
Not until we try to find a way to get to Olympus, insisted Orfu.
Monmouth sighed and communicated the request for help in getting to the large volcano.
He transmitted images of Olympus Mons as he'd seen it from orbit, and asked if there was any way the LGM could help them travel either overland over the Tempe Terra Highlands or east along the Tethys coast for more than 4,000 kilometers, then south along the Alba Patera coast to Olympus Mons.
That is not possible.
What does he mean? Asked Orfu when Monmouth relayed the response. Does he mean it's not possible to help us? or to travel east that way.
Monmouth had felt something like relief when the LGM translator had all but pronounced their mission over, but now he forwarded Orfu's request for clarification. Not possible for you to travel east secretly because the dwellers on Olympus would see you and kill you.
Ask him if there's another way, said Orfu. Maybe we could go overland along the Kasei Vallis.
No, you will go to the Noctis Labyrinth by Falaka.
What's a Falaka? Asked Orfu when Monmouth relayed the answer. It sounds like an Italian dessert.
It's a two-masted, Latin-rigged sailing ship, said Monmouth, whose training for the black underseas of Europa had included everything available in download about sailing the liquid seas of Earth. Used to ply the Mediterranean millennia ago.
Ask them when we can leave, said Orfu.
When can we leave? Asked Monmouth, feeling the question as a vibration through his fingers and a tickling in his mind.
The stone barge arrives in the morning. The Falaka will be with it. You can leave on it.
We'll need some other things salvaged from our submersible, said Monmouth. He sent the images of the device and the two other pieces of cargo in the hold, visualized it being brought ashore and transported to the sea cave. Then he sent the image of LGM rolling Orfu to the same cave. As if in response, dozens of the little green men began to wade and paddle back out to the ship. Others walked closer to Orfu and began arranging the rollers into an Orfu-sized pallet. I don't think I can hold this man's heart any longer, Monmouth said to Orfu over the comm. It's like grabbing a live electric wire.
Let go then, said the Ionian, but let go.
Monmouth thanked the translator, thanked all of them, and released his grip. Just as with the first translator, this little green man fell to the sand, twitched, hissed, dried out, and died. Oh, God, whispered Monmouth. He leaned back against Orfu's shell. The little green men were already lifting the Ionian's bulk, sliding rollers under him.
What are they doing?
Monmouth described the translator's body and the work all around him, their preparation to transport Orfu and the device and other objects already being hauled in from the ship, the cables being attached to the sub, the hundreds of LGM pulling at the cables from the shore, already dragging the Dark Lady west toward the ocean cave, where it would be safe from airborne eyes. I'll go with you to the cave, Monmouth said dully. The translator's body was like a dry, shriveled brown husk on the red sand. All of the interior organs had dried up and the fluid had flowed out of it, making the mud under it run like red blood. The other little green men ignored the translator's corpse and were already beginning to roll Orfu along the sand toward the west.
No, said Orfu. You know what you have to do.
I already described the faces to you when I saw them from the sea.
That was at night, through the periscope boy, said Orfu. We need to look at one or two of them in the daylight.
The one at the base of the cliff is in pieces, said Monmouth, feeling like whining. The next one is a full kilometer to the east, way up on the cliffs.
You go ahead, said Orfu. I'll stay in touch on comm while they trundle me off to the cave. You'll be able to see how they handle the lady during most of your walk.
Monmouth grudgingly complied, walking east away from the crowd of LGM, pulling his dead sub along the coast, and rolling Orfu toward the cool shadow of the sea cave. The fallen head was in too many pieces to make out its features. Monmouth struggled up the steep trail that the little green men had descended with such apparent effortlessness. The path was narrow and frighteningly steep and wet sandstone slick. At the top, Monmouth paused a second to recharge his cells and to look around. The Tethys Sea stretched out as far as he could see to the north. To the south, inland, red stone gave way to low red hills, and several clicks further south, Monmouth could make out the green of forests of shrubs on the foothills. There was some grass along the path he followed east along the edge of the cliff. Monmouth paused to look at the pad and prepared hole for the face the little green man had sacrificed in shoving off the cliff to pry open the hold bay doors. It had been prepared carefully, and Monmouth could see how the stem at the base of the great stone head's necks slid down into the hole in the stone and then locked in place. These little green men were craftsmen and skilled stoneworkers. Monmouth walked east. He could see the next head along the eastern horizon. The Moravec was not designed for walking. His role was mostly to sit in an exploration submersible, sometimes to swim, and when he grew tired of being a biped, he altered the workings of his joints and spine and padded along like a dog for a while. When he reached the next stone head, he paused by its broad base, seeing how the stone at the neck had been filled in with something like cement. He looked east at the path the rollers and thousands of LGM had created along the cliff top, and west to where the green mob had pulled the sub and pushed Orfu almost to the headland cave.
"There yet?"
came Orfu's voice. "Yes, leaning against the thing."
"How about the face?"
"This is a bad angle from beneath," said Monmouth. "Mostly lips and chin and nostrils."
"Get out on the beach again. These faces are meant to be seen from the sea for some reason."
"But," began Monmouth, looking down at the steep cliff dropping at least 100 meters away to the sand. There was a faint path on the greasy rock just as at the other site. "If I break my neck getting down there," he said, "it's your damned fault."
"Understood," said Orfu. "I can feel the vibration as they move me along here, but I have no idea how close we are to the cave. Can you see?"
Monmouth magnified his vision as he looked to the west. "Just a couple of 100 meters from the overhang," he said. "I'm going to climb down now. Are you sure you want me to check the next head as well? It's another kilometer east, and the heads looked all the same from orbit."
"I think we should check it," said Orfu.
"Sayeth the Vec with no legs," muttered Monmouth. He began the long, steep descent to the beach. He stood as far away as he could, backing up until the low waves lapped at his legs. The face was distinct, but not familiar. Saying nothing lost in his own thoughts, he walked another kilometer east along the water's edge. The next face was identical to the first, proud, imperious, commanding, its visage staring fiercely out to sea, a sculpted stone showing an old man's face, mostly bald on top but with long hair flowing back on either side of the wrinkled face. Small eyes under hard, downward slashes of eyebrows, wrinkles at the corner, high cheekbones gouged into stone. A small but firm chin, thin lips curving into a frown, and the same severe countenance. "It's an old man," Monmouth said on the comm. "Definitely an elderly human male, but I don't recognize him from the history databanks." There was only static for a few seconds.
"Fascinating," said Orfu. "Why would an old man from Earth deserve thousands of these stone heads all along the Martian coastline?"
"I have no idea," said Monmouth.
"Is he one of the chariot people?" asked Orfu. "Does he look like a god?"
"Not a Greek god," said Monmouth. "More than anything else, he looks like a powerful but dyspeptic old man. Can I come back now before one of the toga-wearing greybeards in a chariot does come flying along and sees me standing out here gawking like a tourist?"
"Yes," said Orfu. "I think you should come back."
23. Texas Redwood Forest. Odysseus didn't tell the story of his travels that morning during breakfast in the green bubble atop the Golden Gate at Machu Picchu. No one remembered to ask him. Ada thought that everyone seemed preoccupied, and she soon realized why. Ada was preoccupied because she'd slept little but spent the most wonderful night of her life with Harmon. Ada'd had sex before, what woman her age had not, but she realized that she'd never made love before. Harmon had been exquisitely tender yet eagerly insistent, attentive to her needs and responses but not controlled by them, sensitive but forceful. They slept a little, coiled together on the narrow bed by the curving glass window, but woke often, their bodies renewing the lovemaking before their minds were fully engaged. When the sun rose over the spire to the east of Machu Picchu, Ada felt like a different person. No, that wasn't right, she realized. She felt like a larger, fuller, more connected person. Ada thought that Hannah was also acting strangely that morning, flushed, hyper-alert, attentive to every comment the man who called himself Odysseus made, glancing at Ada occasionally and then looking away, almost blushing. My God, Ada realized, just as breakfast was ending and they were ready to leave, to fly north together to Ardis Hall, Hannah slept with Odysseus. For a minute, Ada couldn't believe it, for never during their friendship had Hannah ever commented on being with men or on sexual matters. But then she caught the glances Hannah was giving the bearded man, and the physical signs, the young woman sitting across from Odysseus, but her body still reacting to every move the man made, hands nervous, leaning forward. And Ada realized it had been a busy night in the domies atop the Golden Gate. Demon and Savi were visibly the odd people out. The young man was in no better a mood than he'd been in the night before, barking questions about the Mediterranean basin, eager to get going on his adventure with Harmon and Savi, but obviously nervous about it. Savi seemed withdrawn, almost sorrowful, and in a hurry to leave. Harmon was quiet and, Ada thought, obviously still focused on Ada, although not obvious about it to the others. She caught his glance once or twice, and something warm moved in her chest when he smiled at her. Once he put his hand on the outside of her leg under the table and patted twice. "So what's the plan?" Demon asked as they were finishing their breakfast of hot croissant. Ada had watched in amazement as Savi had baked the bread earlier, and butter and berries and fresh-squeezed fruit juice and rich coffee. "The plan is to fly Odysseus, Hannah, and Ada to Ardis Hall. We're running late if we're to get them there before dark. And then for you, Harmon, and me to go on to the Mediterranean basin," said Savi. "Are you still game for that expedition, Demon Ur?"
"I'm still game."
Demon did not sound game to Ada. He sounded tired or hungover or both.
"Then let's get our gear in bags and our asses in gear and go," said the ancient woman.
They flew out on the same Sony they'd flown in on, even though Hannah told Ada that there were other flying machines hangared in one of the rooms attached to the south tower of the bridge. The little Sony had a surprising number of compartments at the rear for Savi's backpack and their other gear, but it was Odysseus who carried the most baggage, including a short sword in a scabbard, his shield, changes of raiment, and the two javelins he had used to hunt the terror birds. Savi lay in the front center depression, handling the glowing virtual controls, with Ada on her left and Harmon on her right. Demon, Odysseus, and Hannah filled the three concavities behind them, and Ada glanced back once to find her friend looking longingly at the bearded man. They flew east over high mountains and then dropped lower and turned due north again, passing over thick jungle and a wide brown river that Savi said was called the Amazon. The jungle itself was solid rainforest canopy, broken here and there only by a few blue glass pyramids, whose apexes were 1,000 feet high, parting low-moving rain clouds. Savi did not tell them what the pyramids might be, and the others seemed too tired or preoccupied with their own thoughts to ask. A half hour after the last of the pyramids had disappeared behind them, Savi banked the Sony hard left and they flew west by northwest across high mountains again. And the air was so high and thin here that the force field bubble popped up even at their apparent low altitude of 500 feet or so above the terrain. And the air in the bubble pressurized again to a higher oxygen content. "Aren't we going out of our way?" asked Harmon after the long silence. Savi nodded. "I had to give a wide berth to the Zorin monoliths that run along the coastal shelf of what used to be Peru, Ecuador, and Colombia," she said. "Some of them are still armed and automated."
"What are these Zorin monoliths?" asked Hannah.
"Nothing we have to worry about today," said Savi.
"How fast are we traveling?" asked Ada.
"Slowly," said Savi. She glanced at the virtual display surrounding her wrists and hands. "About 300 miles per hour right now." Ada tried to imagine that speed. She couldn't. She'd never traveled in anything faster than Voynich's pulled droshky before their first trip in this Sony. And she'd had no idea how fast a droshky went. Probably not 300 miles per hour, she thought. Certainly the mountains and ridges below were flicking past much faster than the familiar countryside had in the droshky or carryall ride between the fax portal and Ardis Hall. They flew on another hour. At one point, Hannah said, "I'm getting a sore neck, craning to look over the edge of the Sony, and the bubble's too low to let me sit up. I wish..." She screamed. Ada, Demon, and Harmon let out similar yells. Savi had moved her hand through the virtual control panel, and the solid Sony under them had simply disappeared. In the brief seconds before Ada closed her eyes tight, she looked around at the perfect illusion of the six humans, their luggage and Odysseus' spears flying along in midair, unsupported by anything. "Warn us if you're going to do something like that again," Harmon said shakily to Savi. The old woman muttered something. Ada spent a full minute or two touching the cold metal of the cowl ahead of her, feeling the soft, leather-like solidity of the contour couch beneath her legs and belly and chest, before daring to open her eyes again. "I'm not falling, I'm not falling, I'm not falling," she told herself. "Yes, you are falling," her eyes and inner ear told her. She closed her eyes again, opening them just as they came out of the highlands and followed a peninsula running northwest from the mainland. "I thought you might want to see this," Savi said to Harmon, as if the rest of them wouldn't know what they were talking about. Ahead of them, the ocean sliced through the isthmus, open water visible for a gap of at least 100 miles. Savi gained altitude and turned them north across open seas. "The maps I've seen show old the isthmus connecting North and South America above sea level the whole way," said Harmon, straining up out of his couch to look behind them. "The maps you've seen are useless," said Savi. Her fingers moved and the Sony accelerated and gained more altitude. It was past midday when another coastline came into sight. Savi dropped the Sony lower and they were soon flicking over swamps, which quickly gave way to mile after mile of redwoods and sequoia. Savi named the trees, the tallest towering 200 or 300 feet into the humid air. "Anyone want to stretch their legs on solid ground while we stop for lunch?" asked Savi. "Or have some privacy in case nature is calling?" 4 of the 5 passengers loudly voted aye. Odysseus smiled slightly. He had been dozing. They had lunch in a clearing on a small rise surrounded by cathedral giants. The E and P rings moved palely through the bit of blue sky visible overhead. "Are there dinosaurs around here?" Demon asked, peering into the shadows beneath the trees. "No," said Savi. "They tend to prefer the middle and northern parts of the continent." Demon relaxed against a fallen log and nibbled at his fruit, sliced beef and bread, but sat straight up when Odysseus said, "Perhaps Savi is actually saying that there are more ferocious predators around here that keep the recombinant dinosaurs away." Savi frowned at Odysseus and shook her head, as if sighing over an incorrigible child. Demon looked into the midday shadows under the trees again and moved closer to the Sony to finish his meal. Hannah, rarely taking her gaze off Odysseus, did take time to pull her Turin cloth from a pocket and set it over her eyes. She reclined for several minutes while the others ate silently in the shadowed heat and stillness. Finally, Hannah sat up, removed the microcircuit embroidered cloth, and said, "Odysseus, would you like to see what's happening with you and your comrades in the war for the walled city?" "No," said the Greek. He tore off a strip of cold terror bird left over with his white teeth and chewed slowly, then drank from the wineskin he'd brought with him. "Zeus is angry and has tilted the balance toward the Trojans led by Hector," continued Hannah, ignoring Odysseus' reticence. "They've driven the Greeks back through their defenses, the moat and the stakes, and they're fighting around the black ships. It looks like your side is going to lose. All of the great kings, including you, have turned and run. Only Nestor stayed to fight." Odysseus grunted, "That garrulous old man. He stayed because his horse had been shot out from under him." Hannah glanced at Ada and grinned. It was obvious that Hannah's goal had been to draw Odysseus into conversation, and equally obvious that she thought she'd won. Ada still didn't believe that this all-too-real man, sun-bronzed, wrinkled, scarred, so different than the firmery, renewed males of their experience, was the same person as the Odysseus of the Turin drama. Like most intelligent people she knew, Ada believed that the turncloth provided a virtual entertainment, probably written and recorded during the Lost Age. "Do you remember that fight by the Black Ships?" prompted Hannah. Odysseus grunted again. "I remember the feast the night before, that miserable dog's ass day. 30 ships arrived from the Isle of Lemnos, bringing wine, 1,000 measures full, enough wine to drown the Trojan armies with, if we hadn't had a better use for it. Eumaeus, Jason's son, sent it as a gift for the Atrides, Agamemnon and Menelaus." He squinted at Hannah and the others. "Now Jason's voyage, there's a story worth hearing." Everyone except Savi looked blankly at the barrel-chested man in his belted tunic. "Jason and his Argonauts," repeated Odysseus, looking from face to face. "Surely you've heard that tale." Savi broke the embarrassed silence. "They haven't heard any tales, son of Laertes. Our so-called old-style humans here are without past, without myth, without stories of any sort, except for the turncloth. They're as perfectly post-literate as you and your comrades were pre-literate. We didn't need scratches on bark or parchment or mud to make us men to be reckoned with," growled Odysseus. "Writing had been tried in some age before ours, and had been abandoned as a useless thing." "Indeed," Savi said dryly. "Does an illiterate's tool stand any less erect?" "I think Horace said that." Odysseus glared. "Will you tell us about this Jason and his what?" asked Hannah, blushing in a way that convinced Ada that her friend had indeed slept with Odysseus the night before. "Argonauts," Odysseus said slowly, emphasizing each syllable as if speaking to a child, "and no, I won't." Ada found her gaze wandering to Harmon and her mind wandering to memories of the long night before. She wanted to walk off with Harmon and talk to him in private about what they'd shared, or, failing that, just to close her eyes in the humid heat of the sun-dappled glade and nap, perhaps to dream about their lovemaking. Or better yet, thought Ada, peering at Harmon through lowered lashes, we could just steal off into the forest dim and make love again rather than just dream about it. But Harmon didn't seem to notice her glances and obviously had his lover's telepathy receiver turned off. Ada's beloved appeared to be amused and interested by Odysseus' comments. "Will you tell us a story about your Turncloth War?" he asked the bearded man. "It was called the Trojan War, and fuck your Turan rag," said Odysseus. But he'd been drinking steadily from his wineskin and appeared to have mellowed. "But I can tell you a story that your precious diaper cloth doesn't know." "Yes, please," said Hannah, shifting closer to the warrior. "The Lord deliver us from storytellers," muttered Savi. She rose, packed away her lunch package in the boot of the Sony, and walked into the forest. Demon watched her go with visible anxiety. "Do you really think there are worse predators here than dinosaurs?" he asked no one in particular. "Savi can take care of herself," said Harmon. "She has that gun weapon." "But if something were to eat her," said Demon, still staring into the forest, "who would fly the Sony?" "Hush," said Hannah. She touched Odysseus' wrist with her long tan fingers. "Tell us the story that the turncloth doesn't know, please." Odysseus frowned, but Ada and Harmon were nodding in agreement with Hannah's request, so he flicked crumbs out of his beard and began. "This experience wasn't and won't be shown in your Turan rag tale. The events I will share with you now happened after the death of Hector and Paris, but before the wooden horse."
"Paris dies?" interrupted Demon.
"Hector dies?" asked Hannah.
"Wooden horse?" said Ada.
Odysseus closed his eyes, combed fingers through his short beard, and said, "May I continue without interruption?" Everyone except the absent Savi nodded. "The events I will describe to you now happened after the death of Hector in Paris, but before the wooden horse. It was true in those days that among its most potent treasures, the city of Ilium possessed a divine image that had fallen from heaven. You would call it a meteorite, but a stone cast and formed by Zeus himself generations before our war, as a sign of the father of the gods' approval of the founding of the city itself. This metallic stone figure was called a Palladion, because it was in the form of Pallas. Not, I should explain, Pallas Athena, as we call our goddess, but Pallas, Athena's companion in her youth. This other Pallas, the word itself can be accented to have a feminine or masculine meaning in our language. But here it is close to the Latin word virago, which means strong virgin, had been killed in a sham fight with Athena. And it was Ilios, sometimes called Ilus, father of Laomedon, who in turn would be father to Priam, Tithonus, Lampus, Clytius, and Hysetaon, who had found the star stone in front of his tent one morning, and who recognized it for what it was. This ancient Palladion, long a secret source of Ilium's wealth and power, was 3 cubits in height, carried a spear in its right hand and a distaff and spindle in its left, and was associated with the goddess of death and fate. Ilios and the other ancestors of the current defenders of Troy had ordered many, many replicas of the Palladion in many different sizes and hid and guarded these false statues as surely as they did the real one, since everyone knew that the continued survival of Ilium itself depended on their possession of the Palladion. It was the gods themselves who revealed this fact to me in dreams in those last weeks at the siege of Ilium, and so I told Diomedes of my plan to go into the city and locate the true Palladion so that he and I could return to the city, steal it, and seal Troy's doom. First, I disguised myself in rags as a beggar and had my own servant whip me with a lash, thus disfiguring myself with stripes and welts. The citizens of Ilium, you see, were notoriously weak-stomached when it came to disciplining their servants. They tended to spoil slaves more often than punish them, and no Trojan servant serving a good family would be allowed to go abroad sporting torn clothes and flogging stripes. So I reasoned that rags and stench, and most important, the bloody whip marks, would make the citizens turn away in embarrassment upon seeing me. A perfect disguise for a spy, don't you think? I chose myself for this task because I was the stealthiest and craftiest of all the Achaeans, and also because I had been within the walls of Troy before, more than 10 years earlier, sent there to lead a delegation tasked with peacefully negotiating the release of Helen before our black ships arrived in force and a war began. Obviously, those negotiations failed. All of us true Argives had hoped they'd fail, since we were spoiling for a fight and hungry for plunder. But I well remembered the layout of the city within those great walls and gates. In my dream, the gods, most likely Athena, since she favored our cause more than any of the others, had revealed to me that the Palladion and its many replicas were secreted somewhere in Priam's royal palace, but did not tell me where in that palace it might be hidden, nor how I could tell the real Palladion from its many pretenders. And I waited until the deepest hours of the night, when the rampart fires are at their lowest and the human senses are at their weakest. And then I used grapple and rope to go over the towering walls, killing a guard as I did so, and hiding his body under fodder stacked high within the walls for the Thracian cavalry. Ilium was large, the largest city in the world, and it took me a while to navigate its streets and alleys to Priam's palace. I was challenged twice by armed sentinels in the streets, but I grunted and made strangled sounds while gesturing meaninglessly with my whip-bloodied arms, and they judged me an idiot slave, well and truly whipped for his idiocy, and they let me pass. Priam's palace was large. It had 50 bedrooms, one for each of Priam's 50 sons. And it was well guarded by the most elite of Trojans' elite troops, with alert guards at all the doors and outside each street-level window, with still more guards within the courtyards and on the palace walls. No sleepy sentinels would idly wave me on here, no matter how late the hour, or how bloody my stripes, or how idiotic my grunts. So I made my way south a few blocks to Helen's home, which was also well guarded, but less so after I knifed my second Trojan of the night and hid his body as best I could. After Paris' death in an archery duel, Helen had been given in marriage to another of Priam's sons, Deiphobus, whom the people of Ilium called the Router of the Enemy, but whom we Achaeans referred to on the field as Oxen Buttocks. But her new husband was not at home this night, and Helen slept alone. I woke her. I don't believe I would have killed Helen if she had cried for help. I had known her for many years, you know, both in my role as guest in Menelaus' noble house and, before that, as one of Helen's first suitors when she became eligible for marriage. Although this was just a formality, since I was happily married to Penelope even then. It was I who had counseled that Tyndareos should take an oath of the suitors to acquiesce to Helen's choice, thus avoiding much bloodshed from the loser's bad manners. I think Helen always appreciated that advice. Helen did not cry out for help that night. I awakened her from her troubled sleep in her home in Ilium. She recognized me right away and hugged me and asked after the health of her true husband, Menelaus, and of her daughter so far away. I told her that all were well, although I did not tell her that at this point in the war Menelaus had been seriously wounded twice on the battlefield, and moderately wounded half a dozen times, including his recent arrow in the hip, and was in a surly mood. Instead, I expressed to her how much her husband and daughter and their family in Sparta missed her and wished her home and well. Helen laughed then. "My lord and husband Menelaus wishes me dead, and you know it, Odysseus," she said. "And I am sure that he will do the deed himself when the great walls and sea and gate of Ilium fall away soon, as Cassandra has prophesied." I did not know this particular oracle. Delphi and Pallas Athena are the only seers of the future who have my ear. But I could not argue with her. It seemed probable that Menelaus would indeed slit her throat after all the bitter years of her disloyalty in the arms and beds of his enemies. But I did not tell Helen this. Instead, I told her that I would intercede with Menelaus, son of Atreus, convincing him to spare her life if Helen would not betray me this night, but would help me find a way into Priam's palace and instruct me on how to choose the true Palladion. "I would not betray thee anyway, Odysseus, son of Laertes, true and crafty counselor," said Helen. And she told me how to pierce the palace defenses and how to know the real Palladion when I saw it amongst its imitators. But it was almost dawn, too late to complete my mission that night, so I went out and down the streets and up and over and down the wall through the gaps I had left by killing the watchman. And I slept late the next day and bathed and ate and drank and had Machaon, the son of Asclepius and the finest healer in the army's pay, dress my flog wounds and apply a healing salve. The next night, knowing that I would need an ally since I could not fight and carry the heavy Palladion stone at the same time, I enlisted Diomedes in my plan. Together, in the deepest hour of the night, the son of Tydeus and I went up over the wall, killing this sentinel with a well-placed arrow. Then we moved quickly down the streets and alleys. No dumb show as flogged slaves this night, but rather efficiently and silently killing any who challenged us, and made our way into Priam's palace via a hidden sewer drain that Helen had told me how to find. Diomedes, a proud man like so many of those thick-skulled heroes from Argos, did not like wading through a sewer for any purpose, not even to ensure the downfall of Ilium. He grumbled and bitched and pissed and moaned, and was in a truly foul mood by the time we added insult to injury by having to climb up through a hole in one of the 10-man crappers in the privies of the palace basement, where Priam's treasure vaults were located in the midst of his elite guard's barracks. We were stealthy, but our stench preceded us, and we had to kill the first 20 guards we encountered in those corridors. The 21st showed us how to open the treasure vault doors without tripping alarms or deadfalls, and then Diomedes cut that man's throat as well. In addition to tons of gold, mountains of precious stones, deep pools of pearls, stacks of inlaid fabrics, chests of diamonds, and much of the rest of the wealth of the fabled East in those vaults, there were 40 or so statues of the Palladion arrayed in niches. They were alike in everything except size. Helen said to take only the smallest, I said to Diomedes, and I did so, wrapping the Palladion in a red cape I had taken from the last guard we'd killed. We had the downfall of Ilium in our hands. All we had to do now was escape. This is the point when then, that night, at once, immediately. The lure of all that plunder was too much for the greedy, brainless bastard. Diomedes would have traded 10 years of our blood and toil for a few hundred pounds of gold. I dissuaded him. I will not describe the fight we had when I set the red-wrapped Palladion on the floor and drew my sword to stop the son of Tydeus, king of Argos, from ruining our mission through his greed. The fight was over quickly, won by stealth. All right, if you insist, I'll tell you. No noble combat here. No glorious Aristeia here. I suggested that we remove our reeking tunics before fighting, and while the great Lummox was disrobing, I threw a 10-weight lump of gold at the great ox and knocked him cold. In the end, I ended up fleeing Priam's palace with the heavy Palladion in the crook of one arm and the heavier naked Diomedes slung over my shoulder. I couldn't carry him over the wall like that, so I was ready, willing, and on the verge of leaving him by the cesspool of sewage where the great drain let out near where the river ran under Ilium's walls. But Diomedes regained consciousness right then and agreed to leave the city with me. We departed quietly, very quietly. He did not speak to me again that day, nor again that week, nor after the fall and plunder of Ilium, nor during our preparations to sail for home. Nor have I spoken to Diomedes since that day. I should add that it was shortly after that, after I bore away the Palladion to our Argives' camp where we hid it well, sure now that Troy was in its final hours, that we began work on the gigantic wooden horse. The horse had three purposes. First, as a ruse, of course, to carry me and a carefully chosen band of my staunchest fighters into the city. Second, as a means to have the Trojans themselves remove the great stone lintel over the Scaean Gate in order to let the votive offering pass into their city, since prophecy said that these two things had to come to pass before Ilium would fall, the loss of the Palladion and the destruction of the Scaean lintel. And third and finally, we crafted the great horse as a gift to Athena to make up for the loss of her Palladion, since she was also known as Hippia, horse goddess. Since it was she who had bridled and tamed Pegasus for Bellerophontes, and she who took such pleasure in riding and exercising her own horses at every opportunity. And this, my friends, is my short tale of the theft of the Palladion and the downfall of Ilium. I hope the telling pleased you. Are there any questions? Ada caught Harmon's eye. This was his short tale? She thought, and saw her lover catch her thought like a blown kiss. Yes, I have a question, said Demon. Odysseus nodded. Why do you call it Troy some of the time and Ilium the rest of the time? Asked the pudgy young man. Odysseus shook his head slightly, rose, took his scabbard and short sword from the Sony, and walked off into the forest. 24. Ilium, Indiana, and Olympus. Zeus is angry. I've seen Zeus angry before, but this time he is very, very, very angry. End of side 8.